Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Thursday, September 1st, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. Please do consider subscribing to the magazine if you are not already. Check out barnesreview.org for all the details. And today I am joined by Henry Herskovitz, an activist and a supporter of historical revisionism. All right, Henry Herskovitz, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
I'm doing real well, John. Thanks for starting this up, and it's good to hear your voice again.
Yeah, it's always good to catch up with you. We've done interviews, I want to say, on two previous occasions. And I've been following your activism and your legal battles, which we'll get into in just a few moments, for a number of months. In fact, I've written a couple articles for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, dealing with some of your the legal cases that have been brought against you for your activism. So that's a topic we'll get into as well, because I know there are some updates on that front. And also, we actually published a pretty lengthy written question and answer, basically like a Q&A, in the July-August 2022 edition of the Barnes Review, where we addressed your long struggle for free speech. We talked about your activism. We talked about your views on a variety of topics, including historical revisionism and, you know, really bringing history into accord with the facts, which is, of course, what the Barnes Review is dedicated to. And we talked about kind of just your introduction to revisionism, the concept of revisionism, your history with Ernst Zundel. So it turned out to be a really good Q&A. And I've done these before for the Barnes Review in the past. I actually did a pretty good one with Monica Schaefer up in Canada. We did a pretty lengthy written Q&A that was published in the Barnes Review. That was about a year and a half or maybe even 2 years ago now. But it's kind of cool. I think it's a good format for really allowing somebody to kind of get their ideas out, to address some basic prompts, you know, in a written question form. And I think it turned out really good. So, of course, I would encourage people to check that out. You can visit barnesreview.org. Get a subscription to the magazine if you do not subscribe already. It really is America's last revisionist publication. Probably one of the last revisionist publications in the entire world, I would venture to say. And, you know, it really is a magazine worth supporting. So I don't know, Henry, if you had any comments on the article. I thought it turned out really good. I really do.
Well, I liked the article. I thought it was good. Are we talking about your article or the article that the fellow wrote from the Jewish Daily?
Oh, no, I was referring to the article that appeared in the most recently published edition of the Barnes Review.
I like that a lot. I think it's important for people like me that may have things to say, but sometimes we get, you know, gagged up on our own activism, because mostly my activism is standing, holding signs. It's not talking. So it's very helpful when I get a friendly narrator or questioner like you that can prompt the questions and get the information out of me, kind of tease it out of me a little bit, because without that, without those prompts, it's difficult for me to get started sometimes.
Right. Yeah.
So wound up in what I'm doing that that I fail to get the communication out there. That's why I try to get a visual report out once a month or something like that. To keep the people that follow me and follow our work here in Ann Arbor apprised of the situations, you know. That's
right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I know you know, much of your activism, and you've been engaged in activism for over 20 years now, right? I mean, it's, you guys have been 20. On the streets of Ann Arbor, Michigan, the home of University of Michigan, for a very long time. And much of your activism has focused on really confronting some of the most taboo topics in America, including the reality of Jewish power and influence in this country, Israeli aggression and terrorism and, frankly, genocide that they are committing against the Christian and Muslim Arab population in Palestine, in occupied Palestine. You know, you've also talked about 9/11 and, of course, the Holocaust and the concept of Holocaust revisionism. So to kind of get started, can you kind of just give us an overview? You don't got to get into all the details, but it really is, you know, you really do have a history of engaging in a on-the-streets battle for free speech in this country, right? I mean, that's what this is all about.
Well, I think so. You know, during the pandemic or scamdemic, whatever you however you prefer, we were the ones that thought that we were the essential workers because we were out there protecting our First Amendment. When and, you know, we were that's what we were doing. We were out there saying our point of view. Saying our opinions, expressing ourselves with signs, and doing it on public property in a way that that conformed with all the notions of a First Amendment right that a country like our country has granted us.
And yeah, entirely peaceful, entirely legal, I should add as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And so when we get sued by a fellow from outside of Ann Arbor, from Canton, Michigan, close by, you know, he goes into the synagogue and tries to draft two people to be plaintiffs in a suit and talks them into filing a lawsuit against us. And probably knowing that we don't have much in the way of finances to defend ourselves. That's referred to as a slap suit. Maybe we talked about that earlier, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. And it's designed to bleed dry the defendants. And, fortunately for us in this case, we found, some pro bono lawyers that were experts on the First Amendment, and, they have taken the case, all the way through and have been with us right up until the end, which occurred in May of this year, where the Supreme Court denied their last writ of certiorari, trying to appeal their case to the Supreme Court after the district judge, Victoria Roberts, dismissed the case. And then the plaintiffs appealed to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in Cincinnati, Ohio. And they affirmed the district judge's findings that the case didn't have merit. And in fact, the district court judge, Victoria Roberts, awarded about $159,000 of attorney fees to be paid by the plaintiffs and their attorney. The guy who started all this, a man named Mark Susselman, and I was just reviewing before we started this conversation his last salvo. It's a 132-page tome about why he doesn't think he should have to pay the $160,000 that the judge has awarded our attorneys.
Oh boy, I can imagine that would be quite an interesting read.
it's so convoluted. I mean, it brings to mind the Hebrew or Yiddish word called pilpul, P-I-L-P-U-L, and it means to just tease an argument to death, just to get the results that you want, no matter if you have to you know, call heads a tail, you know, or a blue sky gray. To try to convince your audience that you are right. And this guy has done that, and he's continuing to do this. He's now accusing the district court, federal court judge, Victoria Roberts, of anti-Semitism. Of course, I was just going to say,
that's pretty typical. I mean, literally, you disagree with a Jew in a public way and you're an anti-Semite, you know?
Right. And in this particular case, Victoria Roberts is a black woman. And he, in this last salvo of a 132-page document is bringing in charts that allegedly show that African Americans are more willing to be anti-Semitic than the rest of the population. And so he is just violating any code of decency, of morality, of ethics, you know, and this guy still gets to practice law in the state of Michigan, which is beyond me. I mean, I think he should have been disbarred with one of his appeals to the appellate court, because it was so filled with racist remarks, using the N-word and calling Italians by their derisive name and Arabs and Muslims. It was just an article that just dropped my jaw and said, why is this guy allowed to practice law? So we'll see what happens with this. We'll see what happens if he's going to be held eventually responsible to pay for this. And you mentioned the article about me in the Jewish Forward, the Jewish Daily.
I actually haven't even brought that up yet. We talked about that prior to the podcast starting.
We talked about that offline. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know what I was going to mention, because you first came on my radar when I read an article in a Jewish newspaper called The Allgemeiner, and it was quoting Judge Roberts, who was the original judge, correct?
Correct.
That made the ruling dismissing the charges that were brought against you. And mm-hmm. also, I believe, the city of Ann Arbor, Michigan, if I'm not mistaken. And she had a lot of very, very powerful things to say in her ruling, and, you know, totally affirming your rights to your First Amendment rights, your free speech rights, basically saying that everything you guys have done is totally in line with local laws, with federal laws, with, you know, the First Amendment, you know, free speech protections and everything. So it was a really powerful ruling, a very substantial, in my view, victory for the First Amendment when, you know, we see so many setbacks for free speech in this country almost on a daily basis.
Absolutely.
So that was really wonderful in my view to read that. And then, of course, you mentioned it got challenged and taken to the circuit court, and then the circuit court, from there, it was also challenged to the federal Supreme Court, which they refused to hear. So it's been, you know, a long process, right? And these people that have come after you have basically exhausted all of their legal options, it seems like, at this point. And now they're just basically fighting to prevent this fine from being leveled against them, correct? Is that where we're at right now?
That's where we are at this point. Yeah, that they want to avoid payment, and in Victoria Roberts' opinion, it was a frivolous case.
And like absolutely,
I said,
it was
a slap suit, and unfortunately, Michigan doesn't have anti-slap suit legislation on board, and so these cases have to be heard all the way through, and then it will be a great lesson to other people who want to bring slap suits against, not saying we're destitute, but regular people don't have $160,000 in their wallet to pay attorneys. It will be a good lesson to keep other attorneys in line to say stop doing these slap suits, these frivolous charges being brought against us. I mean, so, you know, the I think Victoria said that that the First Amendment, you know, is really only tested when sometimes opinions, people get insulted by other people's opinions. That's the exact time where the First Amendment has to step up and be strong and say,
yeah,
if my words hurt others, I'm still allowed to use my words. And
yeah, well, the whole point is to protect controversial speech.
Yes.
To protect, you know, dissenting opinions, you know, speech that may offend or, some people may, you know, disagree with. That's the whole point of the First
Right.
Amendment. Yeah.
Yeah. I was talking to, we'll get into it later when we bring up that other article. Some people are, you know, assuming that our signs are anti-Semitic. And when we say no, and They say, oh, what sign would be anti-Semitic in your opinion? And I said, well, if we held a sign that said we hate Jews, I guess that would be the definition of anti-Semitism. But we don't, you know. Or if we say had a sign that said kill all Jews, you know, that would be anti-Semitic. But we don't, you know. And so that's the thing that people can't get their heads around. We're saying things that many people feel that Jews have an outsized influence in our foreign policy, our being, of course, America's foreign policy. And it's, you know, been supported by works of Mearsheimer and Walt when they talk about the Israel lobby. And of course, in Israel, they call that the Jewish lobby because it's not Israeli based. It's Jewish based. And that's the whole that's part of the issue that I think needs to be fleshed out and discussed.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, that's really all you've been trying to do with your public activism. And, you know, it was funny. It's kind of related to this because I was on Twitter right before we started the podcast. And are you familiar with it's a relatively new video sharing platform called Rumble?
Yes.
Yeah,
I'm a little bit familiar with that.
Okay, yeah, and yeah, you know, I don't use it all that much. I don't think I even have a channel. I've seen videos on Rumble in the past, but it's not something I visit regularly, anyways. But the founder of it, Chris Pavlovsky, is the guy's name. Mm-hmm. He made a tweet earlier this week that was really interesting. He was basically saying that, and he's sort of describing like the purpose and the mission of Rumble. Is to provide a voice for everybody on the internet. He specifically said everyone deserves a voice on the internet. And that sounds well and good, but what about people that question the official Holocaust story or criticize Jews or point out basic yet, you know, very inconvenient facts about Jews? Do they deserve a voice? Can they express their opinion on the internet? And that sort of, again, goes to the heart of what does it mean to truly have free speech in a country that is founded upon this sort of principle, right?
Absolutely.
And I don't think you can say that we have free speech in America if we can't openly talk about these subjects, no matter how alienating they may be to some people, no matter how controversial or taboo or offensive they may be to certain people. If we can't talk about these things, then we really don't have free speech, in my opinion.
Well, I agree, and I guess we'll see what was his name, Pavlovsky?
Pavlovsky, yeah. He seems like a good guy, I mean, from what I've heard and seen of him.
I think I saw
him. And the platform does seem to be sort of dedicated to free speech. You know, there's a lot of interesting channels and people that have been censored on YouTube and stuff like that on Rumble. But, I mean, you know, again, these topics go to the heart of the free speech question in America. Because they really are the most taboo, controversial topics that one can talk about.
Absolutely. The definition of Jewish power is the power to make sure that Jewish power is never discussed.
Absolutely. Yeah. Who's that? Gilad Atzman that said that? Yeah.
Gilad Atzman. Yeah.
It's a brilliant way of assessing the situation, and it goes right to the heart of the matter.
Yes. I'm on a Facebook a group here in Ann Arbor, and I'm specifically been told I can't use the term Jewish power. And when I on an aside email or a text messaging, I wrote the monitor of the group, and I said in Israel there's a political party called Jewish Power. You know, I mean, and I can't use it.
There's books written by Jews called Jewish Power in America that like go through and document in detail.
Yeah, that's
the political power. Yeah, the political power Jews have. Yeah, the financial power, the media power. Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. Well, and see, and this might be something we could get into as we proceed here. But what explains this like total aversion and this total inability for huge segments of the population? Like, they literally can't even bring their mind around to like objectively or rationally dealing with some of the points that you or I would make about Jewish power. It's like there's this psychological barrier, and I think a lot of it has to deal with the official Holocaust story. right? It really is sort of like this mind control program, this like MK Ultra programming that has impacted the entire country, the entire world.
Well, it's certainly true. And as my last vigil report, I wrote about it, and I think that might have been one of the reasons that you were keyed up to get in touch with me again, John, is that you know, when things are going bad for Israel, what the power does is to gin up the Holocaust industry. And so next month in September, 3 weeks from now, we're going to be blessed with another Holocaust film. This a 6-hour presentation, a mini series by Ken Burns.
I saw that. That ought to be interesting.
Great work, but my God, he's falling forward as well. And I think it's the beginning of a shakedown here in the United States. And pretty soon, your tax dollars are going to be paying reparations for sons and daughters of Holocaust survivors.
A lot of state governments already do that. I wouldn't be surprised if there's federal money going to explicitly like Holocaust survivor type organizations. I know there's a lot of money flowing into the coffers of organized Jewish groups in America for security. What is it? The Department of Homeland Security,
yes.
Nonprofit security grants. It's like literally like 95% of that money goes to Jewish organizations. So, I mean, they have a number of different rackets, and a lot of it, again, has to deal with this Holocaust story and this Holocaust industry that has been created over the years as a result of this largely fabricated, fake aspect of history.
I gave a little PowerPoint presentation recently to some people on a Zoom meeting, and I was allowed to produce a 20-minute presentation on the Holocaust, and so I did, and I entitled it "Seeking the Truth: Historical Event or Religious Dogma," and I went through some of the things that have impressed me over the years that have caused me to become a Holocaust revisionist. One of the most powerful things I got from a book called Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil. And the author, Gerard Menuhin, I guess the son of the violinist Menuhin, talks about, and I can tell people now, you know, that during World War II, I wasn't there, but you know, Dwight Eisenhower was there, Winston Churchill was there, and Charles de Gaulle was there, and they wrote their memoirs after the war, and they in total combined 7,000 pages of their memoirs, but you will not find the word genocide referring to the genocide of the Jews. You will not find a mention of a gas chamber, or you won't find any mention of 6 million Jewish victims of the war. And this to me is like astounding that these people, these three guys who were there, could have missed something that is purported to have been so great.
Yeah. I mean, these are like the most powerful leaders, you know, amongst the Western allies, right? We're talking about, the president of the United States, the prime minister of England, and then de Gaulle was what, the president of the
France,
Free French Republic or whatever it was called. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think to me, those are things that a reasonable person should step back and say, oh my God, you know, how could they miss something that we're taught was so huge? We were taught that 6 million Jews were turned into bars of soap and after they were gassed in chambers these are the big things that I come away with. You know, I come away with things like, the claim that there does not exist a single wartime photograph of a homicidal gas chamber. That simple statement blows me away, you know, and it's undeniable. Nobody can say, oh, Henry, here's a picture of a homicidal gas chamber. They can't do that. Now I'm reading a book called 6 Million Factor Fiction by a guy named Peter Winters, and he has photographs, wartime photographs of fumigation gas chambers. But you know, so those existed, but there are, of course, there are no photos of homicidal gas chambers, and the conclusion is that because there weren't any, and these, you know, to me, these outstanding pieces of information just rock my world, and I don't see why that doesn't rock everybody's world. And the answer is because we've been so steeped, so dipped into this narrative throughout our whole lives, that when someone comes and like me and says, hey, what about this? What about the fact that you can't show me a single photograph taken all during the 6 years of the war, then I just get ridiculed and thrown out of clubs and associations and golf courses that I can't play golf on anymore because I hold these views. And to me, it's impossible to perjure yourself. So I can't go back and say, oh, yeah, there were gas chambers. You know, that would get me maybe back into the club. But I have to live with myself, and I just don't think I could.
Wow, that is incredible. Well, good for you for standing up for what you believe in. Yeah, it's definitely not an easy thing to do, that's for sure. And this topic, I mean, it's so difficult for people. I mean, really, because the point that I was trying to make is that most people have been just so traumatized with the official Holocaust propaganda, the survivors, the Hollywood movies, the overall narrative, the photographs, the images. I mean, everything about it, everything about the official Holocaust narrative is designed to psychologically and emotionally exploit people and to attack them on a very, very deep psychological level and really prevent any sort of rational or critical thinking about the matter. I mean, that's really what this boils down to. And, you know, it explains why it's so difficult for people to think critically about these subjects and to actually even entertain some of the ideas or perspectives that you're putting forth.
There's a saying that you cannot argue somebody out of a position that they didn't argue themselves into. And this is exactly the test case of that. Because it's not a matter of arguing people into their position. You have just drip by drip have fed them intravenously almost this narrative that has been built up since the 60s. And and so when you get to a point where you say something critical of the Holocaust, people become so offended immediately, and then when you ask them, have you read any revisionist material on this subject, that's when they just cut you off, because they can't, you know, they create such a discord in them, a cognitive dissonance, that they can't bear the thought of continuing this conversation, and so they resort to ad hominem or exclude you from the environs. And that's exactly what's happened to me, and I'm sure to you and to anybody else who considers themselves a revisionist.
Yes, that's very, very much exactly what has happened to me over the course of the past 10 years or even more at this point. Yeah, it's you know, just people can't, they don't want to hear you out. They don't want to entertain what you're trying to say, the perspective you're offering. And again, it ought to be called the Holocaust Mind Control Program, because that's really what it is. I mean, it is a psychological program, a fear-based program that is designed to just totally exploit a target audience psychologically and emotionally, and it's very, very, very effective. So, well, I'll tell you what, I'm sure we'll probably get back into this Holocaust topic. But I did want to bring up an article that I found very interesting, and you actually sent me a link to it in your last email. It's from the Jewish Daily Forward, a publication that I have followed for years they actually do a lot of really good reporting, and you can learn a lot about the Jewish community, about their power and influence in society, about some of the things that Jews are up to, basically, you know, some of their political ideas and their political agendas. So it's a very interesting, very professional newspaper. And there was an article that was written about you that was very interesting, pretty balanced, at least for the most part. It did have some of those sort of slanderous terms. And in fact, one of them is right in the headline. Born and raised Jewish, the man leading 19 years of protests against a Michigan synagogue embraces anti-Semitic tropes. So, I'm curious. I want to start off by asking you, what exactly is an anti-Semitic trope? and do you embrace them?
That's a very good question. I'm not certain that I know the complete definition of the word trope, but the I did write the article. The author of the article, Stuart Hain, after the article was published, I said, "Well, if a trope is true, is it still a trope?" And and he just could only respond back, "Well, I guess it's in the eye of the beholder," which of course that's where it all is. I mean, I'm a Holocaust denier because the ADL has labeled me a Holocaust denier. It's these are the people that have the power. And of course, if you talk about this power, then you're an anti-Semite and you will be shut out of any other conversation. But I liken it to in a baseball game where the pitch is thrown and it's so high that the catcher has to leap up to catch the ball and the umpire calls it a strike. Well, it's recorded as a strike, you know, and that's the same thing we're happening here. If I'm an anti-Semite or if I'm a Holocaust denier, or if I'm any of these labels that people, throw at me, if the people throwing at me these labels at me are powerful enough, like the ADL, like the Jewish Daily Forward, then I am what they say I am, because there's no argument back. And it's exactly like the Holocaust denial laws and trials in Germany, when they have someone like Ernst Zundel, a man whom I met, he goes to trial and he's not allowed to present evidence to, exculpating, evidence that would get him, that would support the claims that he's making. And then, you know, right now we have a case of Ursula, Haverbeck, a 93-year-old German woman that they're going to put in prison again for a year. And she, you know, they claim she refuses to recant. She refuses to, admit that she was wrong, because she can't admit that she was wrong, you know, otherwise she would be perjuring herself. And God bless her. She's a hero that we should all look up to.
Absolutely. Yeah. But I've been following her case for a number of years. I mean, she's had legal problems in Germany for, I mean, what, going back 10 years, probably, maybe not that long, but she's been in trouble with the German authorities for her views about the Holocaust for a long time.
Yeah.
As have many other people. I mean, you know, it's not just limited to Ursula Haverbeck. There have been a lot of people that have gotten in legal problems in Germany for publicly expressing points of view that are contrary or question officially established narratives.
Yes.
I mean, talk about tyranny. That's in-your-face tyranny. It's ridiculous.
And it's all over our ability to communicate with each other. Facebook has very strict laws about this now, right? That you can't violate that and still be a member of the Facebook so-called community. When Israel was bombing Gaza recently, a couple months ago, a friend of mine on Facebook was in a little snaggle with a Zionist Jew and who was claiming that they were talking about the second temple. And my friend said, "Well, keep bombing and maybe you'll find it." And he was thrown off Facebook for saying that.
Wow. Yeah, that doesn't surprise me anymore.
He's received a permanent ban. I mean, I think that we have to, really go after some of these things. It's just, I was just made aware, and I think this is the truth, that the FBI approached Mark Zuckerberg prior to the 2020 elections and said, start banning people that are talking about the Hunter Biden laptop.
Yeah, I saw that. He was actually interviewed by Joe Rogan, and he explained how FBI officials approached the company. I don't think they like went to him directly, but they came to Facebook and said, look, you know, there's going to be we have intelligence suggesting that there's going to be a lot of Russian disinformation coming out.
Uh-huh.
A lot of it connected to Biden and his son. And so, yeah, Facebook was – he was basically admitting that he essentially created policies at Facebook to suppress that information by deeming it as Russian disinformation. And yeah, that's very typical. We saw that in all these big social media platforms. And it's amazing how just, like, in your face they are now with this, like, just openly admitting it. Like, yeah, we basically suppressed legitimate information – not only, you know, like from an institutional level, like at the FBI, but remember, I mean, even after the scandal broke in the New York Post, they were thrown off of Twitter. You couldn't post links on Twitter or I think you could on Facebook, but I know it was definitely censored on Twitter where you couldn't even post a link to a story addressing the situation and reporting on it factually. You know, that's how bad the suppression was. And it just shows you how all of these top media, you know, social media platforms collude openly with the government, you know, to suppress points of view and opinions and even factual information that they, you know, don't want out there to the public.
Well, I think there is a big difference between the company acting on their own. And I relate that back to the billboard companies here in Michigan and Ohio that we contracted with to put up billboards that said America first, not Israel. And when Jewish organizations realized that these billboards were up, they contacted the billboard company, and the billboard company took them down. And they hid behind the fact that they're a private organization and they can do what they want. The link I think that's important here is that this is, and you said it, the government, you know, when the government openly colludes with this private organization to suppress information, that's a violation of the First Amendment. It's not a violation of the First Amendment if Billboard Company A decides to cancel my contract because they're just acting on their own. Yes, certainly you and I know they're acting under pressure from the Jewish community to do this, and they're probably being threatened of a lot of revenue, a loss of revenue if they don't take down our billboards. But that's a private act. When you get the government coming in and saying to these private companies, do this or that, that to me is a real heads up to free speech advocates that our freedoms are really being eroded here. I've been taking this real seriously because that's Biden's use of the DOJ and the FBI to serve his political ambitions. I think it's a real sad state of affairs for Americans. I mean, here we are.
Oh,
sending
it's outrageous. Yeah,
we're sending billions to Ukraine. And there's a narrative behind that. And when you say, hey, I haven't been given a chance to vote on those billions of dollars, you know, then you're told to shut up. You know, I mean, Tucker Carlson has it right. You know, you're just a Putin stooge when you say things like that. When you say things like, well, maybe Russia had some national interests that were being eroded by NATO expansionism in Europe, then you become another hated member of the group. But I think it all comes back to the Holocaust. If you can get away with jailing people for their views on that particular historical event, then you can launch off and jail people for saying that Russia has national interests that they were trying to protect by invading Ukraine. Now, you know, or if you say something like, you know, while we were disconnected, I saw a friend of mine posted a picture of her daughter with a bandage on her arm, and I'm so tempted to say, you know, you got the COVID jab for your daughter, and it's just, I feel terrible for the little girl, you know, because here's a chemical that's been shoved into her body that's not a vaccine, that's been proven, and there's a lot of health risks associated with that thing. I don't know why you would put a little girl through that. But this is a good friend of mine. I'm probably just going to keep my trap shut about it. But it's, you know, if you go talking about that, you can be threatened with removal from Facebook. And this is, you know, I think that anybody in this country that claims to be in favor of free speech, you should slap a document right in front of them and say, here's a document that says free Ursula Haverbeck immediately. Would you sign this document? And see what they do. I mean, that would be a great test, you know.
That's all well said. I completely agree with you.
So,
well, I wanted to get back to the Jewish Daily Forward article because there was a few things I wanted to bring up. And like I mentioned, it is actually a pretty fair and balanced article. I mean, for the most part, at least it explains your legal situation, the unsuccessful lawsuits. It does quote you pretty matter-of-factly, sort of, you know, talks about your activism, the issues that you engage in activism on, and some of the things that you say and stuff. So in that sense, it at least gives a fair assessment or a fair depiction of what you're all about and some of your activism and stuff, and of course explains the lawsuit situation. But of course, right at the beginning, it talks about how you embrace quote-unquote anti-Semitic tropes, and I basically understand that to mean like an anti-Semitic like stereotype or something like that. I think that's kind of what they're getting at with that, with the usage of anti-Semitic trope. You hear that often from groups like the ADL, for example. But they also invoke another one of these totally weaponized words, and they say that you basically embrace baseless conspiracy theories. And they specifically cite Israel's role in the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And they also talk about how you reject the historical record of the Holocaust, as if the historical record of the Holocaust is not in dispute when it absolutely is, and revisionists make very powerful and legitimate critiques of it. And in fact, in my view, have systematically debunked every aspect of it. I mean, let's be serious about this. There have been, you know, dozens of books written addressing virtually every aspect of the Holocaust from start to finish. And you know, nothing in my view anyways, and I think anybody that's looking at this objectively would have to agree, nothing of the official story really stands at this point. It's been totally systematically debunked by legitimate professional scholars, historians, chemists, you know, scientists. I could go on, you know?
Yes. It's very difficult. I gotta say, with this article by this author named Stuart Ain, I really enjoyed talking with this guy. I mean, you know,
yeah. What was he like? I'm curious.
He's my age. He was a month older than me, and it was like talking to my Uncle Moishe or something like that. You know, I mean, I have Jewish roots, and though I reject Judaism now and I reject being a Jew, I want out of the club because that's all it is a club. Yet there was still something there that was undeniable, and I was enjoying talking to this guy. And he was able to like switch the whole conversation because he had written a previous article about the attorney for the case in our case, and he was trying to continue to argue his case in the public media. And I had contacted Mr. Ain, and I said, "Hey, if you want to hear our side of this story, give me a call." And he did, but he was able to, instead of giving our side of the story from the legal basis of the protest and stuff, he was able to twist it a little bit and talk about me, which is, I think, unimportant to the struggle. I think that we need to get more things out there, and certainly But I agree with you. He did a pretty good job. I got some of the statements that I wanted to make out there. He talked about the story about the rabbi telling me that Arab children's Palestinian children are taught to hate Jews, and I ferreted that out with the Palestinian women that I met, the teachers, and they all they laughed at me, and they told me that they said, how could we compete with the IDF? And I didn't get the joke, and it was, you know, the joke was because you can't teach hatred. Hatred has to be earned. And these kids saw their parents being humiliated at checkpoints every day. They saw soldiers in tanks marching up and down their streets. That's how hatred is imbued in somebody. You just can't say, you know, I hate everybody whose first name is John. I mean, that there's no sense to that. But there is sense to seeing Jewish people manning checkpoints between Palestinian territory and Palestinian territory. They just stick the checkpoints in there just to harass Palestinians, and that's how hatred is so-called taught. It's not taught in textbooks. You can't do that with people. People have to be shown. You have to earn hatred like that. And that's what I said to Stuart Ain, and God bless him, he published that. So
yeah, I was gonna say, you come across, in my view, I mean, aside from some of these, like, you know, like the baseless conspiracy theory. And one thing about that, whenever they invoke that, you embrace these baseless conspiracy theories, they never actually delve into, you know, what that even means.
Yes.
I mean, like, so, okay, what exactly do you think about 9/11 then? It's just left at, you know, this slanderous, weaponized label, right? I mean, that's basically all it is. It's never actually, like, you're never actually asked to explain why you, for like, you know, you may question the official 9/11 story, or why you would implicate Israel in being involved, when there's all sorts of very legitimate evidence and proof to demonstrate that Israel, at the very least, knew what was going on 9/11. Yeah. I would go much further than that, but I mean, we have police records of Israeli agents being arrested in direct connection to observing and sort of documenting what was going on that day.
Yeah, the, you know, five that's dancing Israelis.
Yeah, and I mean, they were one of, or they were five of, gosh, what was the DEA report that came out? It was almost 200 agents that were arrested across the country in the lead up and after, in the aftermath of 9/11.
Uh-huh.
So there was something very, very fishy going on with these people, and this is not some baseless conspiracy theory. This is a proven fact that you can, you know, even read FBI and DEA and local police reports about, you know, these guys being arrested. It's just dishonest. It's just a dishonest form of journalism when, you know, they inject these sorts of things in there.
Yes, I think that was, there was a time there where I saw this article and I wasn't sure I was going to, publish it myself, like write a visual report about this article that occurred. And, I sent it out to a few of my friends, and one friend of mine, Paul Eisen, who was one of the, original Holocaust deniers, he said, you know, he said, well, you come off as being pretty reasonable. And
yeah, that was exactly my thought after I read it.
And you supported that, exactly. And so I said, well, what the heck? Let's throw this out there, because there are some tidbits of information that I had that get out in this article. I'm sure the Jews are pissed off about this article getting out, because they don't want their opponents to be in any way, shape, or form being seen as reasonable. And in all my interactions with people, John, especially my opponents, you know, I always want to come across as reasonable. I don't want to come across as some lunatic flat earther that starts screaming and bellowing when I get, you know, backed into a corner. If I get backed into a corner and say, I don't know about something, but I'll find it out, I'll do some research and get back to you, you know, that's the best I can do. And I can also admit if I'm wrong. And I've said that to people, especially Jewish friends of mine. I had a Jewish friend that is an attorney, and I said, you know, we were talking a little bit about the subject, and I guess you got to be kind of very careful. And I said, well, you know, I said, if I was proven wrong about the gas chambers, I would admit it. I said, but would you admit it that there are no gas chambers if you could be proven that there were no gas chambers? You know, and he couldn't answer that question in the affirmative. He had to dodge around it and use his pill pull abilities and, you know, and argumentation to do that. And to me, it's just, you know, sure, I'll admit if I'm wrong. But show me I'm wrong. I'm not going to say I'm wrong without any evidence.
Right.
This wartime photograph of a homicidal gas chamber. And I'll run it up the flagpole. I'll take it to, all my friends and say, is this really a legitimate photograph? I mean, in some ways, well, in many ways, I don't want to hear, or see the, Ken Burns, 6-hour miniseries on the Holocaust and the United States involvement. But, Stuart Ain, this author, asked me to do that, and I said I might, but I'll bet right now that Ken Burns does not mention gas chambers, because they're trying to diminish that. They're not you know, playing that tune anymore.
They're trying to memory hole that aspect of the Holocaust.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've done that to many other aspects of the official Holocaust narrative, including the lampshades and the soap from Jewish skin and these sorts of more like really outlandish, ridiculous narratives that were put forth in an official way after the war, and it was just totally absurd and ridiculous and untenable. They had to admit that they were lying about it. And not only that, but I mean, you look at like the official Auschwitz plaque. What was it? It was 4 million at one point. Now it's down to one or something. So, I mean, yeah, it's so many even official aspects of the narrative have changed over the years. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's going to be another one of them. You know, one thing I was going to say, two things about the article that really struck me is, and especially at the end of it, where you guys kind of talk about the Holocaust.
Uh-huh.
He actually really at least presents your views in a way that's non-judgmental and just like straightforward. So you are able to kind of get your ideas out there. And even I'll read a brief excerpt here. He says, films about the Holocaust, including director Ken Burns' upcoming documentary for PBS, are a way for Hollywood to manufacture sympathy for Jews, he added, referring to you.
Uh-huh.
And then he goes on to say, Herskovitz said he has never spoken with a Holocaust survivor, but has visited Auschwitz and Dachau. Still, he rejects the historical record and has convinced himself that there were no gas chambers at these or other concentration camps. He said that Hitler never ordered the mass extermination of the Jews of Europe and that crematoria were only used to dispose of bodies of people that succumbed to overwork, malnutrition, or disease. So he's basically presenting your very legitimate and valid perspectives or opinions about the alleged Holocaust in a way that's relatively non-judgmental. And I think anybody that has an open mind would read that and be like, oh, wow, maybe this guy is onto something here. Let me go, you know, check it out for myself.
Yeah, I'd like to have thought that, or I'd like to think that would be a takeaway from somebody reading that article.
Right.
You know?
Exactly. Well, I mean, of course, and then the very last sentence of the article is, the Anti-Defamation League has labeled Herskovitz a Holocaust denier. So, of course, they have to add that in there. But overall, I mean, it's, you know, if you're going to have an article written up in the Jewish Daily Forward of all places, this is probably a pretty decent article for the most part. One other thing I wanted to bring up that struck me was he actually quotes you talking about the phenomenon of like anti-Semitism, and basically you blame Jews for anti-Semitism, and you have a quote here. I'm convinced that anti-Jewish sentiment always follows bad Jewish behavior. And that is a striking contrast with the prevailing narrative that's everywhere, all the time. I mean, you know, you follow any Jewish publication, you follow any Jewish group like the Anti-Defamation League or, you know, the American Jewish Congress or any of these other groups, and they are, like, almost every single day, you can find multiple stories talking about anti-Semitism, anti-Semitism on college campuses, anti-Semitism rising in major cities, anti-Semitism here, anti-Semitism there, anti-Semitism on social media. I mean, it is just one of these themes that is just constantly talked about by these people, by these groups, by these organizations. In fact, CNN just recently did a feature-length production about rising anti-Semitism in America. You know, I don't know how many people watch these things anymore, but they're like still making documentaries about it and writing articles about it and holding conferences about it. And, you know, it's just this and the way anti-Semitism is framed as this, like, just totally irrational hatred of Jews, when you're saying, no, look, I mean, if people do have genuine anti-Jewish sentiment, it's because of the way Jews act and behave and the agendas that they push. And that is something that you will never hear somebody like Jonathan Greenblatt from the ADL express, right? Anti-Semitism will never be framed that way by these sorts of people.
No, I wish that there would be more studies about, you know, why. My question has been for a long time, why was it so easy for Adolf Hitler to convince his fellow Germans that Jews were their problem? I mean, again, it goes back to something has to make sense before people can believe it. You can't just say men in plaid shirts are your enemy, go out there and hate them. You know, there had to be a reason why Jews were distrusted, feared. I've been really recently, and this may be for another interview that you and I get to do about, what the ideology of the Jewish state and how it's based on the religion that supports that Jewish state. The racism.
Like a truly like supremacist type mindset, right?
Absolutely. There is, I'm trying to find it here. There's a rabbi who was, one of the most, respected Lubavitcher rabbis, the, Orthodox rabbis, in all Jewish history. And he died last 10 years ago, I guess, or so. His name was, Schneerson.
Oh, yeah, yes, I'm familiar.
And, you know, he has, you know, he's the embodiment of the religion. And the, he's said, I'm trying to get a quote here for the general difference between Jews and non-Jews. A Jew was not created as a means for some other purpose. He himself is the purpose. Since the substance of all divine emanations was created only to serve the Jews, you know, and when I,
yeah, and this is a common mindset that you hear expressed by a lot of these rabbis. If you follow Jewish publications, I mean, they will openly report on this sort of stuff.
Yes, yeah, they'll do that, and then they'll get offended when you quote them.
When you quote them and object to it and right. You know, call it out and say, wow, these guys are actually really the supremacists, not quote unquote white supremacists that they continue to go on and on about. Yeah.
That's the, that I've come at this aspect because of my pro-Palestinian stance, and that's what my main focus is. And, you know, you can't be pro-Palestine without being anti-Israel, because there's only going to be one winner over there. The people that support peace, these phony Jewish peace groups, you know, just mask over the genocide. The word that you used earlier, the genocide of the Palestinian people are being created, you know, is ongoing. It's been ongoing for almost 100 years of the Zionist project. But all these peace groups are formed, these Jewish-led peace groups, to protect Jews, where it's Jews doing this thing, you know, and there's no honesty in these peace groups that are trying to say, oh yes, we're pro-Palestinian, but don't blame the Jews for what's happening in, in, in Israel. Well, that's where I get my, you know, that's where I get into trouble, because we do hold Jews accountable. I mean, these are the same people that are practicing the racism that drives the Jewish state. The racism that drives the Jewish state is born and nurtured in the synagogues of this country. They are the ones that are creating an us versus them scenario. And then when you point that out, then you become the them. And even though the rabbis are teaching you that, that the Jews are superior, so much so that the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is like the difference between a non-Jew and an animal. I mean, these are the substrata that supports the Jewish faith that drives the Jewish state. And then when you point this out, when you point out that Jews are powerful and Jews are manipulative, and Hollywood is an owned entity by Jewish elites that run that, and it's the most emotional manipulating, the strongest emotional manipulating tool there is. I mean, you've watched movies and are moved to tears about this and that. I just watched a movie called Just Mercy, which was about blacks being unfairly convicted of murder and eventually released from prison. It's an amazing machine to manipulate our emotions. I refer to Hollywood, and when they are cranking out over 300 Holocaust movies and countless other movies that just talk about the Holocaust inflectually in the movie itself, there's no wonder that people have such a full stop attitude towards any discussion, any rational discussion that you were saying about this historical event. We need to have the discussion. I mean, this is the central topic, I think, that needs to be fleshed out. And I'm really happy for the American Free Press. I'm really happy for the Barnes Review. I'm happy for the Committee for Open Discussion on the Holocaust. These are organizations that are fighting a terribly uphill battle, as well you know. And my hat's off to you and to the writers of American Free Press, Kevin Barrett and Phil Giraldi, and these other of my heroes. And John Friend, put him in there too. So
hey, well, thank you, sir. Wow, that's very, very well said. That's a good way to actually wrap up this conversation. No, that's awesome. Thank you very much for all your kind words and compliments. And you're right. I completely agree with you. I think free and open discussion about the Holocaust and Jewish power and some of these other more controversial, quote-unquote, conspiracy theories like 9/11, for example, or alleged school shootings. These are all topics that should be openly discussed and addressed in a responsible way.
Yes.
And you know, nothing is off limits. We should be able to question and debate any topic. And, you know, again, it goes to the heart of the whole free speech debate. So, and again, you are basically on the front lines, you know, of this battle, of this struggle for free speech. As are we. Everybody that's sort of engaged in this struggle is doing it in their own way, in their own, you know, the circumstances of their life. And it's not an easy thing to do, but I think it's of vital importance.
I agree. I think it's, you know, if we don't do it, who will?
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Well, Henry, thank you very much, sir. Sorry for the technical difficulties. We'll definitely have to do this again. There's never a shortage of topics to talk about. And, thanks a lot, man. I really appreciate it. Thank you for all your help and cooperation with the article, which, again, was in the Barnes Review, the most recently published issue, which is the July-August 2022 issue of the magazine. Check out barnesreview.org. Consider subscribing if you're not already, and you can read the great Q&A that Henry and I did.
All right, John.
Okay, thank you, sir. I'll talk to you later, man.
Thank you anytime.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.